Thank you very much, and as Ian said, thanks for staying to one of the last sessions of the week, and lucky this was in San Diego. Okay, so now I must go forward, huh? Excuse me. Okay. Oh, it's loading. So I'm an epidemiologist, and my interest in research is trying to determine potential causes of adverse pregnancy outcomes that are preventable. So looking at environmental exposures that might impact pregnancy outcome, primarily with respect to risk for birth defects, but also with respect for reduced birth weight, preterm delivery, neurobehavioral impairment, spontaneous abortion, and all other adverse outcomes of pregnancy. Certainly with respect to birth defects, we know about 30% of causes of birth defects are known, but about 60% of causes are unknown. And we know that some of them are caused by environmental exposures that the mom is exposed to during pregnancy, whether it's medications or an infectious disease or a chemical that puts her at risk of having a child with a birth defect, and those things are known as teratogens, for those of you who don't know the definition of teratogen. But we know that some things are human teratogens, but for many things we really don't know what the effect of that medication or that drug or that environmental exposure might be on human pregnancy, and so that's the area that I'm interested in working in. What I'm going to talk to you about today is a sort of that very narrow niche of what Ian covered in providing prenatal care to pregnant women. So it's a group of people who address this specialty area, and they're known as teratogen information specialists. And I'm going to describe to you how teratogen information specialists work with clinicians across the board in trying to promote healthy mothers and babies, and describe to you how this kind of system has evolved. I don't have anything that's related to what I'm going to talk about today. I receive grant funding from NICHD and NIAAA and from March of Dimes, but I also receive grant funding for research grants for collaborative studies that we do on various medications in pregnancy, and it's a consortium of pharmaceutical companies who contribute to this effort. So teratogen information services are a specific idea that started back in the late 1970s, initially in San Diego, California, of all places. And the reason that they came about, or this idea first came about, was, as you probably are aware, back in the 50s and 60s, we first became aware that there were things that people could be exposed to during pregnancy that could actually cause a problem. So the first was rubella. When Norman Gregg in Australia sort of serendipitously discovered that having German measles in pregnancy could cause severe birth defects in children born to mothers who were infected during pregnancy. And then following that, not in the U.S., but internationally, we became aware that a drug, thalidomide, that was initially not marketed in the United States but in other countries, dramatically increased the risk for severe birth defects, for limb reduction anomalies in a high proportion of children whose mothers had taken the drug early in pregnancy. So the sort of public perception of the potential of things that even a mother could take therapeutically during pregnancy having the potential to cause birth defects came into the awareness of pregnant women and clinicians. And so what happened was here in pediatrics at UCSD, a clinician who counseled pregnant women and healthcare providers about birth defects and recurrence risk for birth defects from whatever causes, was getting a lot of calls from pregnant women and healthcare providers asking about, this is a medication that I'm taking, I have to use this antibiotic, I had an outbreak of chickenpox, I have to use these chemicals in the workplace, what are the risks for my baby? And so the situation was that he was being put in a position of having to try to answer these questions, and they became more and more commonplace. and was faced with the issue, number one, of not having a mechanism to answer these many questions. And then also the second issue was that for the vast majority of these exposures, there was no human data to be able to counsel those women. So we could tell, he could tell her what would happen to a guinea pig if she was exposed to this, but not be able to tell her what might happen in her pregnancy. And so he conceived of the idea of putting together sort of a systematic method of being able to provide that information to pregnant women, and as importantly, to put it into the context of how she or her healthcare provider might view this in terms of a risk in pregnancy. In other words, is there a theoretical reason to think that this is a risk? Is there concrete information to think there is a risk? Or is it something that if you minimize your exposure or the exposure has already taken place, there's no reason to think there is a risk? And so that first concept was established in San Diego County and then established or expanded throughout the state of California as the first Teratogen Information Service, or TIS. And since then, these have been replicated in states throughout the U.S. and in Canada, and there are some 35 services in Europe, South America, and Australia, all kind of meeting the same need. The two functions of TISs are service-related, as I just mentioned, and the purpose of these services is to provide evidence-based risk assessment and individualized counseling. So instead of just providing, this is a general statement about this drug in pregnancy, the individualized counseling can address when the woman was exposed, what her dose was in gestation, the underlying conditions, and other factors that might relate to her specific risk profile. And along with providing this risk assessment and counseling, the services provide referral to callers. So referral if they have not already engaged in prenatal care, and referral for other kinds of services, including prenatal diagnosis. And then the second component, which was deemed an opportunity from the very start, was that here's this cadre of women who are calling into Teratogen Information Services to get information, the majority of whom have already had the exposure they're calling about, and it presented this great opportunity of being able to actually collect information on pregnancy outcome for those women who were willing to provide this so that better information could be provided to women in the future. So the other mission of TISs is to conduct exposure cohort studies of pregnancy outcome to try to address the pretty pervasive lack of adequate human data on most exposures in pregnancy, and particularly to do this for new drugs where there's typically no human information available because clinical trials can't usually be conducted in pregnant women. So another goal of TISs is to provide feedback to clinicians, and we think that this is a really important role that TISs play, that clinicians, by and large, regardless of where they fit in the socioeconomic spectrum or healthcare provider spectrum, don't have the time to provide the comprehensive risk assessments and counseling services, nor have the ability to keep on top of the literature for this particular specialty area of clinical practice. And so this is an opportunity for clinicians to partner with Teratogen Information Services to try to provide better care for their patients. In terms of feedback to clinicians, we also can provide clinicians with information about alternative choices for medications if they're considering a particular medication for a pregnant woman when there are other choices that might be equally as effective. We can aid clinicians in making recommendations for prenatal diagnosis that might be relevant to the particular exposure, or situations where prenatal diagnosis wouldn't be relevant to the risks associated with a particular exposure. And then finally, we provide feedback to clinicians regarding research results from the cohort studies that we conduct. And the last thing that TISs do and have taken a more proactive role in recently is to try to address major public health issues. We partnered with the CDC recently to develop a mechanism for providing an emergency response for special the special population of pregnant or lactating women. So, for example, during the hurricanes, we partnered with the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disability to develop, to provide publicity through the CDC and the March of Dimes to let pregnant women know in the area that they were, where they were affected, that they could contact this service to get information specific to their exposures. And then we collaboratively developed a list of educational fact sheets on the kinds of exposures that were likely to happen related to the hurricane. So I think that role is becoming more and more important. The teratogen information services throughout the U.S. and Canada belong to a network called the Organization of Teratology Information Specialists, or OTIS, not the elevator company, but the but an organization that's band together for professional education to keep ourselves current, but also to do collaborative projects. So the OTIS organization has been around since 1985, and this, if you go to the website, otispregnancy.org, there's a variety of different kinds of information there, but one of the things that the website can lead you to is by clicking on the state or Canada, it'll tell you where a service is located, what hours they're open, whether they provide only telephone service, or if they would do face-to-face counseling, and whether they cover pregnancy exposures and lactation. One of the important things that's happened in the last several years is that because we don't have a service in each one of the states in the United States, there are not 50 services and never have been. They're individually funded by individual states through a variety of different resources. What we have done is set up a national 800 number. So if a person calls this national 800 number, the 866 number, whichever area code they're calling from, they will either be routed to the service that serves their state. So if they call from a 213 area code in California, they'll be routed to our service. But if they're calling from a service in Nevada, or a area code in Nevada, they will automatically be routed to the closest state service that's willing to take their call. So we cover the entire U.S. and Canada using this method. Right now, there are 18 services in operation in the U.S. and Canada, 2 in Canada and 16 in the United States. On average, we take between 70,000 and 100,000 callers contacts a year, almost exclusively telephone caller contacts. The teratogen information specialists, there's no, you know, certification program like there is for genetic counselors. Teratogen information specialists usually come from some other health care background and then receive specialized training in order to be able to do this. So the services are staffed by genetic counselors, pharmacists, physicians, nurses, and health educators, and each one has a medical director. Recently, we've had a health economist who's been doing her PhD work looking at the effectiveness and cost benefit of teratogen information services, and she has published a study just recently in reproductive toxicology looking at the overall sort of snapshot picture of who uses OTIS for this kind of information. And you can see here that the vast majority of callers to OTIS are pregnant women. A much smaller proportion on average across all the services, about 12% of calls come from physicians and nurses. We've separated out individuals who call specifically about lactation questions and are not calling about pregnancy and then asking lactation questions at the same time. And a smaller proportion, and this we think is a huge opportunity area, is the proportion of 5 or 6% of women who call us preconception. So this is an opportunity area, for, as you can imagine, for a variety of reasons, but most importantly that the best time to prevent a pregnancy exposure is to think about whether or not you might have the potential to become pregnant and to plan your activities accordingly. The types of exposures that are called about, the vast majority are medications, and that includes prescription and over-the-counter medications. close to 50% of callers, the presenting question is about a medication. A small proportion, about 10%, are asking specifically about lactation. A small proportion about occupational exposures, and then about equal numbers are asking about alcohol, drugs of abuse, or infection. And I think it's important to remember in looking at this that this is the presenting question. So the woman who calls us about the antibiotic that she's just been prescribed, her presenting question is about medications, but she's about 50% of women who call us about an antibiotic in pregnancy have also had alcohol exposure in pregnancy. So the opportunity to counsel not only about the presenting question, but about every other exposure she's had in pregnancy exists, and we take advantage of that as an educational moment. In terms of the kind of specific agents that we are contacted about, this is a table from a study that we conducted a few years ago with funding from the FDA across services over 2-3 month periods of time. And what you can see here is that the number one category of drugs that we're getting calls about are central nervous system agents, including analgesics, but primarily psychotherapeutic medications, followed by respiratory agents, so primarily asthma medications. Another way that we extend our services and partner with clinicians to try to help pregnant patients is we produce fact sheets. And what these are, I've given you a couple of examples here of the front page of two of them. What these are kind of quick and dirty, two-page, two sides of a single sheet, summaries in a question and answer format for individual exposures in pregnancy. So we don't think that these take the place of doing individualized teratogen counseling for pregnant women, because if that were the case, then you could just go to the internet and get what you needed. We think that they are a first step in providing sort of summary information to patients, and that healthcare providers can use these as a mechanism of letting their patients know something about a drug or an exposure in pregnancy, but then encouraging them to make the call to talk to a counselor if, in fact, they've had this exposure. So they're set up in with the pretty much the same questions and answers in about a fifth grade level of language, indicating what the exposure is, what it's used for, what's known about paternal exposure, what's known about the drug in pregnancy, and what's known about reproductive effects, and what's known about lactation, with a limited list of references, and then, of course, our national 800 number. And these are available on the website for downloading, and they're available in English and Spanish, and we have about 100 of them that have been created so far and are kept updated, and we're adding to the list all the time. And they're really widely used. They're, I think, a tremendous resource. We get something like 30,000 downloads a month off of these things. As I mentioned, we also are interested in our research mission, and I'm not going to give you any information regarding these collaborative studies that we conduct, but just to let you know that the opportunity to be able to work with the 18 services across the U.S. and Canada has allowed us to complete a large study on asthma and asthma medications in pregnancy. We've completed a vaccine study. We have an ongoing study on autoimmune diseases and medications used to treat it. There's a study going on led by the Canadians on discontinuation of antidepressants in pregnancy, and then we're collaborating with Tulane University and CDC on a study of West Nile virus in pregnancy outcome. So how do TISs aid the clinician? Well, the first thing is it's important to know that the typical caller to a teratogen information service is in the latter part of the first trimester, so 7 to 10 weeks gestation is about the time the woman's found out she's pregnant, she's gone to the clinician, and then she says, wow, you know, here are the 15 things on average that I've taken or been exposed to before I knew I was pregnant, and now I want to know about these things. So typically she's calling about an exposure that she's already had. So in in that case, for the vast majority of calls that we're getting, you know, a very small proportion are exposures where we already know that there's a risk associated with it. We can provide her that information. But for the vast majority, the counselor's most common function is to reduce the caller's anxiety. We think that that cannot be undervalued, that that's a huge benefit when women can become exceedingly anxious and concerned about an exposure in pregnancy for which there may be no data that suggests that there's an increased risk, or she wasn't exposed in the critical window, or she's read something on the internet that's raised her level of anxiety. So we can take the 20 or 30 or 40 minutes to talk her through the situation and reduce her anxiety, and we can aid the clinician in that way because the clinician likely is not able to take that amount of time to talk to the woman about those specific issues. So by doing this labor-intensive complementary function with a clinician, we think we provide a specialized type of service that aids the clinician in that way. We also aid the clinician by being able to provide the most up-to-date information that he or she may not have the time to keep up with, and that we can provide patient-specific counseling, not just general information about an exposure in pregnancy. In terms of opportunities for prevention, though, the question might arise, well, if the majority of calls are about exposures that have already taken place, what are we doing in terms of preventing those exposures that do pose a risk? So if the woman calls us and she's 6 weeks along and she's been taking valproic acid and she has an increased risk for a child with a neural tube defect, we're not going to undo the neural tube defect if it's already occurred. Or if she calls us and she's been taking Accutane, we're not going to undo the effects of the Accutane in the first part of pregnancy if that in fact has occurred. But we do have opportunities for prevention looking forward. We certainly do get calls from people who are considering an exposure that they haven't yet had or looking at options for specific medications they might use for a condition. The other area that I think we have opportunities for prevention, where we have opportunities for prevention, is by asking women about all of their exposures, not just the presenting exposure. So the exposure that the woman calls about, as I mentioned, might be the medication or the over-the-counter diet product that she was taking, but we have the opportunity when she calls us to go through a kind of list of reminder questions. And as I mentioned, 50% of those women we would expect would have had some alcohol exposure, maybe 10 to 15% have had some tobacco exposure, a smaller proportion illicit drugs, and that those exposures and some medications, the first trimester is not the only critical window, that if we hear from her at 7 to 10 weeks, we have an opportunity to talk to her about what she can do to minimize or avoid those risks in the second and third trimester of pregnancy. We also, I think, fill a function in terms of prevention by counseling women on the importance of continuing needed medications, and I think this is also undervalued, that there is a natural inclination on the part of some women, once they find out they're pregnant, to want to avoid everything in pregnancy. So whether they have a seizure disorder, or they have asthma, or they have a chronic condition that needs treatment, it's been demonstrated for some of these conditions that women will discontinue their medication on their own, or they will start reducing the amount of medication that they're using without working with a clinician in advance to determine whether or not that's the appropriate thing to do. And certainly we know discontinuing needed seizure medications, asthma medications, or psychotherapeutic medications might be harmful to the outcome of pregnancy. So we think we have an opportunity for prevention by talking to women about not abruptly discontinuing or reducing the dose of medication without working with their clinician. Another kind of area which is hard to get your arms around, but how counseling during a current pregnancy can impact a future pregnancy. So we think that what we talked to a woman about today, when she's asking about the valproic acid in pregnancy and she's already had the exposure, that she may not be able to undo what's already happened, but it may cause her to and her clinician to think about how she might deal with a future pregnancy. So in between pregnancies, maybe an alternative medication would be a better choice, or in terms of thinking about her potential to become pregnant, whether or not she could discontinue the medication during during a critical window for exposure. Another way that we think we can impact a future pregnancy is by virtue of gathering complete exposure information from a caller, we can actually advise the woman to continue a pregnancy-related change in behavior that's positive between pregnancies. So for example, if the vast majority of women who are smokers will quit smoking during pregnancy, but a substantial proportion of them will reinitiate smoking after they deliver the baby. The majority of women who find out they're pregnant will quit drinking alcohol during pregnancy. Once women find out they're pregnant and they start taking prenatal vitamins with folic acid or folic acid supplements, they'll continue to do that throughout pregnancy. But then what happens at the end of the pregnancy? As I mentioned, smokers may restart smoking, alcohol drinkers may restart drinking, and people who are taking folic acid supplements, the majority will discontinue until the next time they get pregnant. So I think we do have an opportunity to intervene at this point to encourage women to continue that positive behavior between pregnancies so that in the next pregnancy and that critical early window, they may be protected. And we took a look at the feasibility of doing this a couple of years ago with a graduate student who did a survey among callers in California regarding use of folic acid supplements, so multivitamins with folic acid or folic acid alone. And this summary of this was that about 330 callers that she got to participate in the survey. As expected, about half were not taking folic acid supplements in the periconceptual period, which is the time which would have the most benefit in terms of preventing birth defects. And the predictors of not using these were the ones we would expect that have been shown in other studies, higher body mass index, younger age, non-white race ethnicity, lower educational level, and of course unplanned pregnancy. So then we asked the women whether or not, of those who are not taking folic acid supplements in the periconceptual period, if they would be willing to continue to take them after pregnancy, before the next pregnancy, if advised by a physician to do so. And 25% of that 50% who weren't taking them said yes. Just flat out, if my doctor or my healthcare provider told me to do it, I would do it. So then we asked the remainder, the 75% of those respondents, what would cause them not to follow that advice. And this is just a smattering of what their objections were. Some said it would be too costly for them to take the vitamins, too much trouble. A higher proportion said they thought they caused digestive problems. Not surprisingly, 25% thought their diet was good enough and they didn't need to take the supplements. And then probably the most alarming group is the 35% who said they were not planning a future pregnancy and obviously probably weren't planning the one that they were in right now. So we think that this provided some clues for opportunities for barriers to continuation of folic acid supplements that could be overcome by the teratogen information specialists working in partnership with a clinician to try to address these barriers. A challenge, since the high proportion of unplanned pregnancies in the U.S. Put us in the situation where both the woman and the healthcare provider are not thinking about a possible exposure in pregnancy, but I think an opportunity to address these issues to encompass preconception counseling in the current pregnancy. Other opportunities for prevention, we promote preconception counseling through partnership with agencies or organizations or groups that are dealing with women who have a high likelihood of becoming pregnant. So in California, we're working with some diabetes programs to provide pre-pregnancy counseling or women of reproductive age counseling. We worked really carefully and in depth with WIC in California, and some of the other services have as well. Since it provides services to such a huge proportion of pregnant women and women who have the potential to become pregnant. So they're working with us in California to test a self-administered web-based screening tool for assessment and referral. And they've worked with us to test a health educator intermediary model of screening and referral. We work closely with Planned Parenthood. And then we're working now through a scientific advisory board to try to build partnerships with specialty physicians who are likely to deal with women of reproductive age who are on chronic medications. We're also trying to develop alternative methods beyond the telephone for delivering services. So I mentioned the fact sheets via the web, and we're trying to develop the website as a much more comprehensive source of information. And then we're also testing in some sites providing information via the web, so doing either a live chat or an email a counselor so that the high proportion of people who like to get information that way now and are loath to pick up the telephone might be willing to access information that way. So in conclusion, in this little specialty niche, which addresses what I think has an important role in healthy pregnancy outcome and something that we actually can have an impact on, that TISs have a well-established role in counseling regarding pregnancy and lactation exposures, but that we can improve the effectiveness of this model by extending our interventions to benefit the next pregnancy and by increasing access to women in the preconception period. Thank you.
So let me reiterate, again, thank you so much for attending. There is a sign-in sheet if you came in a little bit later, so please, if you can, please sign in. Okay, the sign-in sheet was right to my right. Are there any questions for either of our presenters?
Absolutely. So it's not just neural tube defects. The evidence is fairly strong that oral clefts and heart defects are also protected against by folic acid supplementation. And you're absolutely right. The impact of, and you know, the March of Dimes and others will tell you that it's just been a really tough sell to try to get women to take supplements through all of their reproductive years, and the response rate has been less than optimum, and it's less than optimum differentially too. So people who might be considered at the lowest or at the highest risk and low socioeconomic status, higher body mass index, are people who are the least likely to be taking the supplements. And food fortification is one way to get at this issue so that the entire population is getting additional doses of folic acid through breads and grains, but it's still not enough. So I think you're absolutely right that that we have to do something that's going to increase the uptake of use of folic acid supplements in women in that critical window, which is the period of time before they get pregnant, so that in the first 4 to 6 weeks they are taking the supplements. That's a good question.
Good question. One of the areas, the way Medicaid rules work now, pregnancy coverage lasts until 60 days postpartum, and then depending on your income level, if you're of a higher income group, you'll drop off of that coverage, and so all that good access might go out the window. We tried to explore through our survey some linkages between Medicaid family planning waivers and Medicaid pregnancy-related coverage, to see the extent to which states try to maintain at least a limited package of care, for example, for family planning, and continue that for women after they've had delivered their babies. There are about 20 states that have family planning waiver programs that, again, set up specific benefits for higher-income women on family planning. And there was pretty good integration between Medicaid coverage and family planning coverage. The eligibility tended to work both ways. In other words, you could be a pregnant woman who delivered your baby and were about to lose Medicaid coverage, in which case you'd be referred to family planning, or you could be a woman who entered the family planning waiver and then became pregnant, and then the coverage went both ways. Does that answer your question to some extent? Okay.
Are there any other questions? Great. Mother Risk is part of the OTIS organization. Yeah, that's, you know, you hit the nail on the head that this is a grassroots kind of a thing that started out small and has stayed relatively small. I mean, you know, 100,000 calls a year is minuscule compared to the number of births in the U.S. And you're absolutely right. Lack of awareness is one of the most hampering things in terms of people being able to access our services. And, it, you know, I think it's a matter of the funding mechanism. We've never had federal funding, and the services all throughout Europe and the South America and Australia, you know, are each funded in their own little silo. So we get funding in California from the State Department of Education, but it's a shoestring. It's just enough for us to support our three or four counselors and to be able to run the 800 telephone line and to provide office space, and not enough to do the advertising that it would take. You mentioned Mother Risk. Mother Risk does a tremendous job. It's a program that's located in Toronto at the Hospital for Sick Children. It's a standard teratogen information service like all the rest of us, but it's integrated very well into the healthcare system, so that the knowledge and the uptake of the services are very high. And I think that that's something that's never taken place in the U.S., that the system in the U.S. has been rather fragmented, and that we could do a lot more towards bringing the system up to that standard that Canada has in the U.S. Are there any other questions? Okay, well, thanks again for sticking it out with us. We appreciate your attendance. And safe travels home.
Graduated next year.
Okay, great.
But we've had a great time. my focus is on African American infant mortality. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got hooked up with Arden and Dr. Collins, Dr. David. Chicago usually has a big representation. We're very big in APHA, very big in maternal child health section. We really do represent. I actually got involved here in IPO. Funny enough, I applied when they hear the funding is gone, but at that time they had NCH Section 2 fellows. I think this is the last year for that. So I know we ran the grant period ended, but in 05 I did applied and accepted. There were 10 fellows, and each of the fellows were paired with self-selected to volunteer and mentors. So my mentors were Tian Parker Domingue and Virginia Pepper, who were the two co-chairs of that time at IPO. And they really, some people never saw their mentors. I was lucky they really integrated me. I taught, we actually were working at that time on a position paper, and I helped to write it. I was one of the authors on racial and socioeconomic disparities and preterm and low birth weight births.
Okay.
And it actually was accepted by the JPC, which is kind of the governing group, in November 06 as an APHA college. So I really hit the ground rolling. And then they recruited me to be a co-chair, and here I am 3 years later. So that's kind of how I got involved in this sort of thing. But, if you come to the NCH section meetings, that's definitely a good start. We have our business meeting usually the Sunday of APHA, usually at 2. We got to move till 8, which is good because we all fly in on Sunday morning. So, and usually for the past couple of years, I've kind of been the main facilitator for that meeting. And then we moderate sessions. So, out of our 4 sessions, this is the one I'm moderating because I'm the only one still here. Tian moderated 2, and Judith moderated 1.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of opportunities for people involved.
Yeah, definitely. And since I'm pretty local to you, if there's anything I can do, let me know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, definitely, we'll calm down. I think Tian will probably need to work on the final report for the year. That will be our next big thing. And then we'll kind of calm down until late February, early March. Right now, and I'll make sure you're on the list, actually. Let me get your email, so I'll make sure you're on the list, sir. Because one of the things we use our business meetings to do is try to hash out, we'll work some of it later, but try to hash out the themes of where we want to go for our abstract call for the following year. So we've kind of been hashing around like how to bring in improved pregnancy outcomes and water for next year. So we've kind of been bouncing ideas around on that. So I'll keep you in the loop for there. So